and welcome back to another episode of Beyond Packaging. I'm one of your hosts, Laura Fodi.
And I'm the co-host, Matthew Wright. Even though you try to get rid of me today, I'm still here. So
I was going to say, Matthew is in Hawaii. I joined and I'm hearing all these birds chirping. And I'm like, where are you? And he's on vacation. So Matthew, this is why I have the reputation I do.
Yeah, well, I know to show up if you're running a show. So I'm here.
We're so grateful. I hope it's a beautiful day in Hawaii. We have a very special guest. One of our favorite people, Jonathan from Nice Pack, is here. But first, we have some really interesting news stories to kick off with. These are two stories of companies trying to make sustainable packaging strides. One is successful. The others are having some challenges. And I think that'll be relatable for a lot of listeners on our call. The first, this is out of Packaging World, Great Earth expands use of fiber-based closures to entire lines. So this is interesting. Great Earth is a nutraceutical brand. They're Swedish, which I think is important, and we can talk about why I think that's important in a second. They rolled out paper screw caps across all of their supplement jars. This is a first large-scale use of Blue Ocean Closures molded fiber technology. So the closure, when you think about a supplement, it's that cap. So now that cap is fiber-based. They went from a pilot to a full rollout, adopted over their entire product range of over 70 jars. The switch did not slow down production. So oftentimes we always think about these things as trade-offs, but it did not slow down production. No exchange of machinery was required. They use the same liner seal as the old bottles. The liner provides oxygen and a moisture barrier and is attached to the bottle, not the cap, so it doesn't affect recyclability. What's interesting is 95% of consumers said they'd choose a fiber lid again, especially since it's not more expensive than competitors who use plastic. So a lot to unpack here, Matthew. What's your take on this story?
Yeah, a couple of things. Brilliant, right? So one thing that's kind of the undercurrent of conversation about alternative materials is not having to rework your whole manufacturing floor. You know, that's a huge cost endeavor. We talk about sustainability costs, kind of product to product, but also the infrastructure costs. So you just said it, you know, the screw cap fixtures, the machines that do that are all the same. So that's a huge win. And then the other thing that caught me kind of by surprise is for a relatively modest size company, 70 different SKUs. So again, which shows the complexity that companies are dealing with right now. And obviously to keep on brand, they need to change all 70, right? I mean, it'd be odd to have some of the brand in plastic, some of the brand in molded fiber. So I think all around brilliant, you know, and also the consumer's acceptance of it. I've seen these caps, maybe not this brand. And to me too, I'm partial to them if they work and if they contain and seal. So I think all around very brilliant, keeping the product very similar, but changing the materials, great.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, consumers are becoming more and more price conscious. I think inflation is something we're dealing with in the States, but I think there are overall challenges and macroeconomic environment issues at play there. And I think what's important if you're a packaging person considering this is, you know, the consumer's willing to make the change if it doesn't impact the price. So to your point, how do you figure out how to make these moves but not impact the price? And I think the driver and the reason I mentioned Sweden, you know, they're in Europe and there's a lot of regulation happening in Europe. So there's kind of these two intersecting points. There's regulation around packaging and sustainability, and then there's the consumer openness to changing. And so if you're a packaging person and a product person, right, because I'm sure product people are heavily involved, if you think about the bottle, critical part, you have to thread this needle of meeting regulatory demands and consumer openness while balancing costs. So, I mean, you and I know firsthand what a challenge this can be. You know, what role does data have in helping people, you know, successfully execute on that challenge?
Yeah, I mean, to your point, the data is critical because it got to the two elements of the data. One is the data of the product, the screw cap itself. So in other words, you know, all the energy and effort that went into designing that, you know, being able to share that, use that for alternative materials, and then ultimately capturing the benefit, you know, what's the cost benefit. And again, if you don't have, you know, good data structuring, good way to manage kind of where it was and now where it's going to, you know, you get past in time and you start to kind of forget where things are at. Now you can go back in history. They have all, you know, potentially they have all the history of that information. So as they make these changes, they know how they're doing and doing better. And they can share that with the consumer, you know, for the consumers to your point that appreciate this and want to buy into this change of strategy. They want data. They want to know it's actually impactful. It's changing things. It's better than something else. And then ultimately, like some of the products we integrate with, like how to recycle and stuff, how does it relate to other waste streams? How do you get rid of it? What does it really do to benefit the earth? So
yeah, absolutely. This next story is a fun one. Philadelphia sues CPG companies over plastic recyclability claims. What a very Philadelphia thing to do. I can say that because I'm from Philly. Big Eagles fan. We famously threw snowballs at Santa Claus at an Eagles game. I was not part of that episode, but Philly doesn't mess around, Matthew, is the takeaway. And I think this is really interesting. So the city of Philadelphia announced a lawsuit against two major CPG companies, SC Johnson, the maker of Ziploc bags, and Bimbo Bakeries. They make, you know, breads that we all probably know and love. And they want these companies to revise marketing claims of their products being recyclable. And the issue is really that consumers are now confused about what is accepted in recycling programs versus not. And so it's contaminating the recycling system and costing thousands of dollars. And it shows that consumers are paying attention to claims that you're making on your packaging, right? And you've always taught me this, but you know, the intricacies of the recycling system are very complex and nuanced. And so there's this balance of making claims, but what is actually going to be recyclable versus not. This seems like a really tough situation, Matthew. There's a lot of good intention here. What is the real challenge?
I think this is a really just tip of the scale. I mean, this is a really interesting because we talk about, when we talk about domestic US policies and we talk about EPR, we talk about 50 different versions, right? Or varied versions of each other. The reality of it, we talked about the municipalities, which is now what you're talking about, are the ones responsible for getting rid of the trash, right? It's not even at the state level and not even at obviously the country level. So now you've seen a really interesting quandary, which is the states are getting involved. I mean, the cities are getting involved. And now, you know, sizes of Philly, think about the complexity of the states layered with city complexity. Maybe Pennsylvania agrees. Maybe the EPR is in line with that. Maybe it's not. Now you get this whole nother level of complexity we never even kind of factored in, which is truly where it's at, because it is the municipalities, it is the local sites that are dealing with how to get rid of this product. And so this is interesting. I think this is going to be a really interesting trend to watch what happens. And it's, again, you know, pulling the data back into it. More than ever, you need to know what your stuff's made of. You need to be able to share that. And that has to be an open conversation between municipalities, cities, states, consumers, because this is not going away. This we've seen, this is only ramping up now.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think, you know, I haven't spent too much time thinking about the data stream between these recycling centers and MRFs and producers. But wow, that feels like an opportunity because they know what their capabilities are, right? They know what kind of specifications and packaging they can accept.
Yep.
And so how do we just continue to make the transformation of data and the connectivity of this information more seamless? I think to your point, to manage all this complexity, it's got to be data driven. And it feels like there's opportunity there. But to your point, if you're a company, it starts with knowing your data. Shout out to our friends at How to Recycle. It is just so important to get that right. And there's a lot of work that Sustainable Packaging Coalition is doing to make it easier for brands to accurately make sure they have the right labels. This is clearly a very nuanced situation. We don't have all the details, but it just reiterates the importance of having your data, generating the right claims, and making sure that you know, that claim fits in the end market. And I think this is a catch-22, Matthew. And I think it's hard to assess blame on this because you can't have a How to Recycle label and different in every state, I'm assuming, right? I mean, I think it begs the question of like, how do you manage this complexity, right? And wow, I mean, we could do a whole episode on that with our friends at SPC. I'm curious what they would say about that.
Yeah, no, I think we have to wrap it up here. I guess it's my last comment is we've got to simplify the complex. You know, that's how I think. And then secondarily, we have to pull everybody into this discussion because you have the consumer with their wants and needs on one side, and you have the municipalities trying to get rid of it, and you got all of us in between. So we've got to have these data conversations, and then again, focus on simplifying that methodology.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of simplifying the complex, we have a guest that has done just that at his company. I'm thrilled to welcome Jonathan to the Beyond Packaging podcast.
Hello. I don't know if I've quite accomplished simplifying it yet, but it is definitely the task at hand.
I love that. You know, we're thrilled to have you on. I've known you for a few years now. You have over 10 years of experience at NICEPAC and oversee the engineering services team, all packaging design and finished product specifications. I myself am a big fan of your products, and I hope you share a little bit more. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your company and what brought you into the world of packaging?
Sure. So Jonathan Rabideau, I've been with NICEPAC Products for 11 years. You know, what brought me into packaging is really the complexities of CPG. You know, I love trying to figure out, okay, well, why is something shaped the way it is? Why do they use the colors they use? Why does it look the way it does on shelf? Driving a lot of those consumer, you know, thoughts into that then design process, you know, and using a lot of that data, right? How do we collect the data that helps drive those decisions?
Absolutely. What excites you most about the industry today? It's changed so much even over the past year.
Yeah. I think for me, I like seeing the transition back to almost a minimalistic design, right? And I think a lot of that is driven off of exactly what you guys were just speaking to, right? With the different complexities, you know, having to shift things into a recyclable format. You know, from an R&D perspective, even in the world of wipes, when, you know, customers wanted to use fluorescent inks and, you know, different, you know, packaging design elements, it really added extra layers of complexity to figure out what is compatible, what can you use, where can you use it, or why can't you use what maybe someone would like. So as that shifts into a more minimalistic design, consumers are starting to understand, you know, it doesn't have to be in a bag just because it was in a bag 5 years ago, or it doesn't have to be in a rigid container because it was in a rigid container, you know, 5 years ago. As we can kind of simplify those designs and, you know, work towards reducing the amount of plastics or reduce the amount of colors used, right? That then opens up a lot more into the sustainable front where, you know, black containers is really difficult to reuse, right? So if we can remove that color, you know, it opens up to a lot of different possibilities.
I appreciate that. And it's interesting you talk about the waves. Like, yeah, it was kind of a skew for everyone, right? And, you know, brand for everybody. And it was this proliferation. It was kind of exciting and fun at the time because it was, wow, you know, we see the store shelves today just really dynamic. But yeah, no, I agree with you. I love the concept of going back, you know, the minimalist approach and more brand centric and kind of narrower focus, and it helps sustainability. So great insight.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, recovering marketer here, I can't help myself. We really have to retrain consumers too, that, you know, to your point, we just talked about the complexity of recycling now and sustainability regulations. And we're so used to like these brands that have bright colors and things are really elaborate. And as consumers, we've gotten so used to seeing those things on shelf and having that be a part of our buying experience. And I think what's really challenging for marketers, especially and packaging folks, is how do you stand out in a world where people are simplifying and kind of maybe reverting back to things that aren't super shiny or super colorful, right? I'm thinking of one company in particular that uses black a lot, and like that's the whole brand. I mean, how, if sustainability is important to you, wow, that's, you've got to really rethink your brand design and how you communicate your attributes to customers. So it really is a challenge. For folks who aren't familiar with NICEPAC, can you tell us a little bit about the company and how people might be familiar with it, even if they may not know the name?
Yeah, it's a name you don't see on any packaging itself. But NICEPAC Products was founded 50, 60 years ago, I believe, in a partnership with KFC for the world's first wet nap. So pre-moistened wipes is what NICEPAC makes. So baby wipes, makeup removers, moist toilet towelettes, your general purpose household cleaners, and we make store brand products. So we partner with the Costco's, the BJ's, the Amazon's, the Target's, the CVS's of the world and make their store brand products.
I love wet wipes.
Like, I do too. I use them for everything.
Big, big fan. I mean, the applications of them are just bountiful. So love what you guys are doing.
Well, what an innovative start. I always like to think of the start of companies and what started them. I've got a great book about that. And so, yeah, you think about eating chicken 50, 60 years ago at a convenience location, which wasn't really the thing. That was a new thing too. And that created downstream challenges. And downstream challenges was eating on the go, which is new. And, eating mobile, which was new. And that created the category at some level. So that's pretty fun history.
The spork and the wet nap created in Mooresville, Indiana.
Wow.
I was just reading on it's tells you the type of reading I do. I was just reading about the spork. So I've got a great new book that talks about the origins of everything. So well, I was just funny. Reading the spork this morning.
I love the jobs to be done theory, which is all about creating products based on, what a customer's hiring a product to do. And it's funny because as soon as you were talking about the origin of the wet wipe with chicken wings, mm-hmm. I'm like, that makes total sense. Because when I'm at a restaurant, when I'm not ordering hot wings, when I'm in a business environment or like where I'm somewhere where I'm not going to have a wet, because you can't be like eating that type of food and then,
Then what do you do with your hands?
Got to eat it with your spork.
But it's like this is the perfect example of product innovation for a real problem, right? Like the problem is I want to eat these things. I'm on the go or I'm in a certain situation. And what would solve that problem for me? A wet nap that had never been created before. So just an example of if you're in the innovation space, focusing on problems are the greatest source of opportunity sometimes for innovation. So we love that. Jonathan, you're at this interesting intersection. What trends are you really excited about? You talked about some of the things you're working on, but what are the trends you're seeing in products and packaging that keep you excited?
Yeah, I mean, I think trying my best to keep up with all of the new regulations, the sustainable push, right? It's really great to see the consumer is starting to back the sustainable journey, right? It's no longer, really trying to push it top down. And it's really getting the consumer involved in that education piece with the consumer on, what works, what doesn't, listening to, kind of your story about Philadelphia, right? As How to Recycle receives that feedback, they were able to rebrand all of their How to Recycle logos, right? And I think that'll really help from an education piece. Where not everything is a chasing arrow, right? Sometimes it is just a trash can. And that, provides that goal for the consumer and for the companies to work towards, to say, okay, I want to take this from a trash can, logo to a recyclable logo, right? And what is that journey? Unfortunately, it typically comes at that cost increase, right? So that's, again, where a lot of those projects and trends continue is, how do we work together to understand, how do we get from point A to point B?
And I think what's interesting, you mentioned the cost increase. I think that's why the regulations are also coming with fines, because I think they're trying to force the hands of companies and say, even if it might cost you more, it's going to cost you more either way. There's now a cost of inaction. And I think that's going to continue to push the industry forward. I think you guys sit at an interesting intersection where a lot of retailers act as brands and now have to also comply with these regulations, but may not have all the information. So why is it so important to be managing packaging data and have the ability to easily share it today versus maybe 5 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. So, for us, it's trying to, you now have this, okay, well, I need all of this data. And it's a massive Excel sheet at the end of a product, right? But knowing that information now allows me to start tracking that information at the very beginning of a product, right? So whether that's at a structure level, breaking down what is my outside layer, what is my sealant, what is my inks, what is my, that allows that, if I can track it at the very beginning of a project, and flow that through into different components, and then flow that through into all of my finished goods, and then flow that through to customers, I'm able to now, through tracking that from the origins, have data ready and available to provide out to, you know, the different states that are requesting different information, or you have different customers that are requesting different information. So we're able to now begin tracking that data and understanding from those different how to recycle or EPR or you know, what data is important, how to track it, and find the best, you know, place to begin tracking that data.
I love it. You're so far ahead, Jonathan. I mean, we talked to so many people who, you know, are at the chaos stage where they're like, oh my gosh, I'm getting asked this question by 50 different people. You know, you've gone from that chaos to now having more control. What advice would you have for people who are considering going on the journey of moving from maybe static data to dynamic, you know, a spec first approach? What advice would you have as someone who's kind of gone through it?
Yeah, I mean, keep asking questions. You know, I think the number one thing I've learned, you know, in my journey of trying to get specifications out of Word documents and out of Excel documents and into some sort of a living, breathing, you know, environment, which, you know, I'm very happy to utilize SpecWrite for that. So, but as that, you know, grows, keep asking the question of, well, why do we track this? Or can we track something differently? And a lot of that is understanding from the consumer, from the state regulations of what information is important, and then filtering that back to, okay, finding the best place to be able to track that. You know, and we're not there, right? We are still on the journey. You know, but it is allowing us to better understand, you know, starting from a point to where we need to go and building those blocks along the way. So that way it's not a, you know, come November, you got to spend 3 weeks trying to gather the data, right? If I've spent, you know, the minutes along the way gathering that data, I now have it available, right? And maybe there's a couple fine tunings you want to do at the very end, which, you know, absolutely, but you know, that is the ultimate goal. And, you know, a lot of that push is around the different sustainable attributes that are needed from, you know, state one to state two or consumer A to consumer B.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think data plays an important part in regulatory and compliance now, but it can also be the springboard for innovation. You know, how do you think about leveraging data to go faster and develop new products?
And I think, you know, real quick, you know, Jonathan, I like the way you're talking about it's a journey, right? So I always have horrible analogies, but it's like if the car was, you know, invented and they didn't drive across the country the first day the car was out, right? And there's a tremendous amount of things to kind of be figured out. But I think today there, you know, we're so nuanced in the beginning on the journey, but there's no excuse today for companies. There's people like Jonathan out there that have figured it out, kind of know the trail, know how to make, you know, get from point A to point B, know the challenges, know what areas to watch for. And, you know, shameless plug, we have Summit coming up in February, where it's hundreds of people like Jonathan getting together and kind of talking about, you know, how things are going, how we keep progressing, how we keep moving forward. We're listening, trying to make changes, adaptations. And so, you know, the reality is people need to do this. You know, people need to move forward. And there's enough Jonathans, not enough of them, but there's a hand swell of Jonathans out there that know how to do this. So, Jonathan, I appreciate your energy, your focus, your visionary leadership in this category.
Much appreciated. Yeah, and that's the continue to ask questions, because we don't know it all individually, but there's enough people out there that are trying to do, you know, something similar, right? So taking bits and pieces from as many people as you can and collaborating and combining it the best you can.
That's absolutely right. Would love your thoughts on the question around innovation, because I think oftentimes, you know, when I talk to executives, they're like, I get that there's a compliance piece, but you know, we care about growth and revenue. So how do you think about the importance of both packaging and data with driving innovation and driving sales even?
Yeah, I think with innovation specifically, if you can understand, you know, what materials, you know, run well on your equipment today or don't run well on your equipment today, it gives you an avenue of, you know, what you can work towards. You know, your first, you know, article you talked about today with the fiber-based closures, you know, the number one thing I got out of that is they were able to do it on their existing equipment, right? So, you know, that's where a lot of the innovation, you know, kind of, you have to understand where you want to go, but also understanding your existing data points of your existing equipment, because that's your current playground, right? And you got to stay within those bounds the best you can, and driving that innovation through different material types or different supplier connections, you know, but understanding your current equipment in order to get there.
Awesome. Matthew, I'm sure that's something you can relate to.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, you know, how I feel. This is, we need to connect the dots. And, you know, one of the dots is what your equipment can run. The other is what materials can run on, where do you get those? So, you know, the world to me is exciting ahead of us, a lot of challenges, but you know, with innovators like Jonathan and others, we'll get there.
I love it. No, I'm thinking wrapping up a few things I heard from Jonathan that I think are so important to remember. Start with why. You know, whenever you're driving change, having people understand why and asking yourself why, so you make sure you're on track, is critical. Asking a lot of questions, because none of us have all of the answers and we can all certainly get smarter. And then I love the last piece, Jonathan, which is like, you've got to understand what you're doing to know what playground you're operating in. And so all of these things together really combine to drive us forward, to help us meet consumer demands, and also to be successful, right? Which is what everyone wants. So appreciate you being on the podcast, Jonathan. I hope to see you in New Orleans in February for Spec Summit.
I plan on being there. Yes.
Good.
Great.
Good.
Look forward to it.
I guess one last question then. For folks who haven't attended Spec Summit, could you just tell us, you know, why it's beneficial to attend as someone who's been a few times?
Yeah, I mean, the real value I get out of Spec Summit is being able to connect with other companies that are a part of that journey, right? Again, where it's, you know, utilizing, you know, you've got amazing resources within the SpecRite team, but really getting a different perspective of how, you know, companies A, B, and C also use SpecRite, or how are they, maybe not at a SpecRite level, but how do they view the spec itself? What information are they gathering? Why are they gathering? Maybe you're gathering that same information, or maybe it's something that, you know what, that would be beneficial to start that journey down, right? So getting a lot of different perspectives is one of the main reasons that I keep coming back. You know, it's really nice to see how different companies view their journey through the EPR regulations or through different state regulations, you know, and what data is important, why are we tracking it, and how can we utilize it, you know, more efficiently.
That's awesome. I appreciate it. And for those listening, you can go to specrite.com and find out all the information for Summit. We're having a Black Friday sale, so you can get a discounted ticket, I think, next week. So we'll have a little bit of fun with that. Jonathan, thank you for joining us. We look forward to seeing you soon, and we'll head off to be on the shelf.
Thanks so much. Great talking to you guys.
Thanks.
Now, this is the exciting part for me. So we're off the shelf with Matt Dingy. Hey, Matt, how you doing? And what do you have for us today?
Good. How are you guys? So today, off the shelf, the first package we have is maybe a well-known brand, but from 1999, and that is one of the original seventh generation detergent bottles, which you can see here.
Yep.
And the back panel. So what I found interesting was the logo and obviously the evolution of the brand and some of the claims here, which are obviously related to the natural elements of the detergent, but also ultra concentrated, and the explanation of the seventh generation from a Iroquois quote, as far as thinking of seven generations ahead. So that is very interesting, because this is not the logo that we are accustomed to seeing for today's seventh generation products.
What era did you think that's from?
So this is from 1999.
Okay, so wow. You know, it's interesting how long we've been on this journey of trying to do things better. I think that's in the human's nature, you know, thinking seven generations ahead. But yeah, definitely, I'd say better marketing, better visibility today. But certainly at the time, you know, we forget it might have been, you know, kind of interesting at the time or stood out against what was going on the shelf at the time. But certainly as time has evolved, the shelves look different, and I think probably a lot more crowded and ability to stand out is more important than ever. But from an actual construct to the bottle, it looks like a pretty sturdy bottle, has a pour spout. Do you know?
Yep. Yeah. You can open it here. Yep. It's got the measuring cup and kind of the traditional pour spout.
I wonder when, that design came out. I mean, it had to be before then, but you know, if you remember prior to that, it was primarily folding carton stock or boxes and powder. And so the liquid generation came out and through the pour spout and the cup. I remember that. So yeah, interesting how it's also kind of stayed somewhat similar from a structural standpoint, even up until today.
Yes. Yep. Another thing you probably can't tell from here, but if I grabbed a bunch of from the collection, other 90s detergent, kind of same contemporary time, these would be much larger bottles. So this is 16 loads for 50 fluid ounces. So I think, and they talk about ultra concentrated. So again, if we did a competitive review, I think what would be striking is how small this is relative to the contemporaries. So again, that concentration element, as well as the sustainability of the product itself, kind of interesting.
Well, this is always my favorite segment. Why don't you just give a quick shout out to the collection, and then we'll catch you next time.
Sounds good. Yeah. So the collection is housed in East Lansing, and it's comprised of $150,000 packages across the decades, from the 50s until the early 2000s. And spans countries, continents, and categories for packaging inspiration and research.
Great. Thanks, Matt. Always look forward to this segment. Stay well.
Thank you. Take care.
Don't think, Laura, that I didn't miss the Eagles